Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. The purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. And to that end, I often like to draw on history. I write history books on the side, and we've got a historian as well as an attorney joining us today, a gentleman by the name of Richard Farley, who wrote a great book called Drop Dead, which is his history of how New York City and state got itself out of the fiscal crisis, the self-inflicted fiscal crisis of the mid-1970s. This is also a story being told in a new documentary called Drop Dead City. Richard has a different take on it, but we're going to focus on solutions as well as what he uncovered in his research and how they apply to our challenges today. Richard, it's great to see you.
Thank you for having me, John. And I don't want to insult real historians by accepting your label as a historian. I try to tell interesting stories, but I'm not quite a historian.
No. Like anybody who writes history is a historian, who does original research. You clearly have done.
You're very kind.
Listen. And I should say you come from a long political family. The Farley Post Office adjacent to Moynihan Train Hall. Your great uncle was one of the bigwigs in FDR's cabinet and ran the postal service and was a possible presidential candidate at one point.
He was indeed.
But that's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about what you learned about New York City's fiscal crisis in the mid 1970s. And how New York got out of it. And why is this relevant? Well, it's not just the mayoral primary New York just had, which was won by a Democratic Socialist, Zohar Mamdani, in a major upset over Andrew Cuomo. It's that, you know, we are seeing a populism on the right and the left, often which doesn't like to deal with fiscal reality, which can work for, it's a little bit like Wile E. Coyote going over a cliff, right? For a while, the momentum carries you, but eventually gravity takes hold. This is what happened in New York City in the 1970s, and the whole thing almost came crashing down. So set the stage for how New York got in trouble, and then we'll discuss how they got out of it.
Yeah, there were a handful of reasons that affected all large cities, industrial cities at the time. And there were a couple that were specific to New York. The first was you had a outward migration of the cities of a lot of middle class and upper middle class residents because the industrial job base moved out of the city, first into the suburbs, then down south, and then, of course, ultimately overseas. At the same time, because of unique factors in America, you had a large migration of mostly unskilled labor and poor people from the South escaping oppression and from Puerto Rico looking for economic opportunity. And this large migration arrived just as those industrial jobs were leaving. Over the course of the 50s and 60s, New York went from being the largest industrial employer in the country to losing three quarters of those jobs. You also had in the early 70s, as a result of the Nixon administration coming to power in 69, a reduction in federal aid to cities as a result of the curtailment of the LBJ programs, Great Society. You also had rising interest rates because of guns and butter economic policies. Of course, interest rates rising wreaks havoc on city budgets, because most of their revenue is fixed and based upon real estate appraisals and other things that are difficult, and income taxes, when there's a recession, income tax receipts are down. Economic recession and rising interest rates occurring 1973 and 74. So those macro issues hurt New York City significantly. Now, two other things, but not every city had a fiscal crisis in 1975, just New York City did. Two other factors were important. One is that New York City, as opposed to most other cities, took on functions that were done by the state or the private sector in most other cities. Had its own courts, had its own prisons, had its own hospital system, has its own universities, and until 1968 ran the subway system before the MTA came into place. So for various reasons, including a lot of jobs and patronage jobs when you have all those services, New York took that on. perhaps most importantly, New York engaged in fraudulent accounting in financial activities to allow it to borrow when it shouldn't have, and in many cases illegally, that contributed to a large indebtedness of New York City to the point where it really oversaturated the municipal bond market. So those were the factors that set the table for 1975.
And you know, I think folks are probably more acquainted with questionable accounting in corporate scenarios that contributed to things like the Great Recession.
Would you like some examples?
Yes, please.
Okay. There was a wonderful man named James Cavanaugh, who never went to college, but was an absolute genius in manipulating budgets and figuring out ways for mayors to borrow money, which is why both Democrats and Republicans promoted Jim Cavanaugh. He ultimately became under Beam, the deputy mayor, the first deputy mayor, the job that Randy Mastro has now. And he would do things like, gee, you know, we can only borrow short term because a city can't borrow long term to fund short term expenses, right? Has to borrow in anticipation of taxes, anticipation of aid, revenue from the state and the federal government, because taxes and federal aid and state aid come in lumpy. Expenses are pretty much even. So it's perfectly okay to borrow on a short-term basis. Long-term borrowing should only be for building schools, bridges, long-term assets. Cavanaugh said,
the operational versus capital.
Exactly. But Cavanaugh was very smart. He said, well, look, you know, teachers have a 30-year career. And wouldn't you say that 10% of teachers' time is teacher training, useful over the lives of their careers? So why don't we deem 10% of teachers' costs to be a capital asset? And then they'd march up to Albany, and Nelson Rockefeller, who never met a debt he didn't like either, by the way, approved it, and the legislature approved it. So they deemed legally a certain portion of these expenses to be capital assets. That's one nice example. They would do other things like, okay, historically, the feds would reject 8%, say, of Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. We'll assume we're going to get 100% reimbursement. And we'll take those receipts and we'll march them down to Solomon Brothers and do a bond issuance backed by those receipts, even though we know that 10% of those receipts are never going to get paid. Okay. We would do
it's like a junk bond, but for a city.
Right. And we would do other things like, or they would do other things like, we need some more revenue, but we've run out of real estate tax receipts to borrow against. So Cavanaugh would do things like send real estate tax bills to embassies, which of course tax exempt. But it still showed up on the roll. You can march it down to Solomon Brothers. You can do a bond deal backed by tax and never going to get paid. So things of that nature. Okay.
All of a sudden, this casket, this all sort of this snowball of debt catches up with them.
Think about it, right? If you go back to the mid 60s, even the late 60s, interest rates were relatively low. So what happens in 72, 73, 72, interest rates spike. So I still have to pay that debt, even though it's borrowed against phony receipts. But what do I do when it comes due? I roll it into another bond issue with more phony tax receipts. But at some point when interest rates are high enough, the accrual on that debt becomes a real problem. You should think about it like an irresponsible relative with a credit card. At some point, the interest charges every month start becoming meaningful. And that's what happened in 1974.
So all of a sudden, the debt comes due.
Correct.
And they thought they could just ultimately get a bailout from Washington. The ultimate backstop.
Correct.
Jerry Ford had taken over from Richard Nixon. He had a conservative Treasury Secretary, William E. Simon. You had Nelson Rockefeller, former New York governor.
Simon ran the municipal bond desk at Solomon Brothers. So he was in on all this from the get-go. Yeah.
So this is part of your point, is that everybody has got a finger in the pie. We should say Fred Trump and Donald Trump are side characters in this as well. But you know,
one of A. Beam's biggest donors,
$25,000 donation, right?
Which was a lot of money in those days. Yeah,
yeah, probably the equivalent of a couple hundred thousand a day. And so that Nelson Rockefeller, this had been going on under his nose. All of a sudden, he's vice president.
Correct.
William E. Simon had run the municipal bond desk, so he knew what was going on.
Correct.
So Why did Jerry Ford and you know, that time the Democratic House dominated House not step up to save New York? Because there are sometimes when people assume that someone else has got your back, you find out that actually, you know, that's conditional.
Here's the mythology. They were always going to bail out New York City. Okay. For two reasons. One still relevant today. One, unfortunately, for New York City, not still relevant today. In 1975, the year before the 1976 election, New York was a swing state. Okay. It had gone Democratic. Three of the previous six presidential elections went Republican. It was very much in play. It was very difficult to win a presidential election without New York in those days. And, Gerald Ford had a very tight line to walk because he needed to win New York. One of the reasons why Nelson Rockefeller was on the ballot, by the way, or at least chosen to be the vice president. And on the other hand, he couldn't really bail out New York too quickly, like Carter did 3 years later for the long-term debt, because he had a man named Ronald Reagan nipping at his heels for the Republican nomination in 1976. Okay. Had there been no credible challenge to Ford for the nomination in 76, the drama would not have been as prolonged. Okay. There is no way that Ford was going to let New York devolve into chaos, because he would have then, as he ultimately did, lose New York in the 76 election. And also relevant for today, no president is going to allow the marquee city of America to devolve into chaos. It would be like the French letting Paris devolve into chaos. It's not going to happen. If you don't think there's a love-hate relationship, America west of the Hudson loves to hate New York City. But what happened on September 12th, 2001? You were there. People were driving in from Montana, South Dakota. If you said something bad about New York, you'd get punched in the mouth in Peoria, Illinois. The fact of the matter is Americans are really not going to let New York fail. So it was known early on the bailout was going to come, probably as early as the fall of 1974. The game was, what are the conditions? Who's going to take credit and who's going to get blamed?
Okay, so let's talk about who, you know, historically, I mean, Hugh Carey, governor of New York for 8 years in the 70s, major character in drama, certainly got handed a state in fiscal shambles and improved its position, right?
Hugh Carey, I think, is he not only played his hand very well, I think he also was a fantastic governor through this period and did an absolutely great job.
Agreed.
Under tremendous, people don't realize the family tragedies that Hugh Carey had. He had a brother die in a plane crash. His wife, with whom he had, I think, 13 kids, died of breast cancer at 49. He had two of his children die in a car crash. This is all before he became governor. And he was raising all these kids by himself. I mean, you want to talk about a heroic figure who never uttered a word, by the way, of these tragedies. Unlike today where, you know, people advertise when they stub their toe. He was very stoic and very brave and very effective. So I have a lot of time for Hugh Carey.
I do as well. I think he's one of the great unsung heroes of New York history. So, you know, also, though, I mean, you know, there are in Drop Dead City, you see union leaders step up at the 11th hour. Al Shanker had been a holdout. He steps up. You know, I know you've got their differing sort of opinions. I think Victor Gottbaum, you know, had been a heroic head of DC 37, District Channel 37 at that time. But the narrative is that everybody at the 11th hour, 11:59, everyone stepped up to do their part to avoid default.
That's
so
not
who
true.
Who are the heroes and who are the villains?
Well, it's not really true. If you take the Al Shanker example, for example, Shanker had agreed to provide the money long before the 11th hour. The problem is that the control board was put in place after he agreed to make the money available, and the control board rejected the union contract that he in good faith negotiated with the Board of Ed. In order to try to overturn that, he reneged on his promise to loan the money to the city. And when he reneged, Carey and A. Beam went around to other union folks, including Victor Gottbaum and the police and the firemen, and they agreed if ultimately Shanker doesn't come up with his piece, they would make up for the lost amount. So that was a complete fabrication. Now, ultimately, he decided to come up with the money, and then came up with this narrative that he tortured his conscience and ultimately agreed to do the right. But I mean, it was all just a power play to try to get his union, which is fine. He's the president of the union. He should be trying to look out for the union members. But this was not some great act of philanthropy.
But they stepped up ultimately,
but it didn't matter because if they didn't, somebody else would. The real hero in the labor movement was Jack Beagle, because Jack was the one behind the scenes coming up with the ideas, getting people to get on the same page. He's a true unsung hero of the fiscal crisis and a revolutionary labor figure.
So walk us through in your recounting of this, how we get back from the brink, what the mechanisms were used, and then let's play it forward. You know, what lessons are there for today?
If you wanted to find coming back from the brink, you know, how did New York City get the best deal that it possibly could? It was always going to get bailed out. So I don't want to create this misnomer that somehow through alchemy or genius or some actions by these figures, the city got the bailout. So it was always going to get the bailout. It got the bailout on pretty favorable terms because it had super majorities and it had very large majorities in the House and the Senate, because the 1974 midterm was an absolute bloodbath for the Republicans. And you had Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, a very close friend of Hugh Carey's. Tip took the whip position that Carey was supposed to get, except Carey got stabbed in the back by some other New York congressman. And Carl Alpert, the Speaker, said, let's not have a fight. Let's just give it to Tip, where everybody likes. But Tip O'Neill was going to make sure that Hugh did not get, you know, hung out to dry here. So having strong relationships with Congress, even with a Republican president, is very important when you're in the majority. Of course, we don't have that now in New York. The other factor which is very important is John Scanlon and his brilliance in manipulating the media. Now, the media were willing participants in the manipulation because they tend to skew left anyway, even then. And they're based in New York. And they all wanted New York to get as much money as possible. So the headlines dropped dead and this narrative that Scanlon constructed, which was very helpful to the city, I think went a long way in ultimately putting pressure on Ford to be more favorable to the city than he would have been absent this public relations campaign. So that's very important. Never underestimate the blocking and tackling of a communications plan, a strategy, a media rollout. And they just ran circles around Ford and his team on that account, which was quite brilliant.
Well, media narratives matter a lot, right? I mean, Lincoln even talked about
absolutely.
How, with public opinion, you can do anything.
Absolutely.
And however, we have a much more fragmented media environment, a much more polarized political
much harder these days. Much harder these days.
So that's just on the ability to spin your way out or spin your way toward a solution. That is more difficult. But the brass tacks of finance are not necessarily that gravity doesn't really change.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Okay.
Yes.
You had a large portion of not enough to get a majority, but you had a large portion of the debt was held by large New York banks, savings and loans and other things in New York. And they really coalesced and led the charge on the restructuring plan. So effectively what you had was an out of court restructuring of New York City debt. And you had coordinated action by the banks and the financial institutions, which may be harder these days, because I don't think there is that concentration of holdings of New York City securities like there was then. That was a huge advantage in terms of the blocking and tackling of getting something done, number one. Number two, you had a very creative lawyer from Paul Weiss named Simon Rifkind, who came up with a plan that he remembered from his youth during the Great Depression, where states passed moratorium laws to help the farmers whose mortgages had gone into default and their farms are being repossessed. Passed a law saying there's an emergency, Great Depression, banks cannot foreclose. That's effectively what happened with New York City bonds. Now, Simon Rifkind knew it was unconstitutional, but he also knew it would take 2 years to work its way through the courts, and 2 years and 2 years turned short-term debt into long-term debt, which was exactly what they wanted to accomplish. And remember, who won the 1976 election? Wasn't Gerald Ford. You then had a Democrat in the White House, Democrats in control of both branches of Congress. So when they had to come back in 1978 to fix the long-term debt, 75 was really about the short-term debt, fix the long-term debt. This wasn't some battle. Jimmy Carter went on the steps of City Hall in a great ceremony and proudly announced he was going to provide treasury guarantees for New York City debt. So the gravitational pull of politics is what determines the outcome, as well as being shrewd in crafting the narrative and tactics of that nature. But you cannot escape the gravitational pull of votes in Congress, votes in Albany, and who sits in the White House.
So, you know, elections have consequences. Power matters.
Absolutely.
What were the reforms that were put in place? We should also mention Felix Royalton and other people who, got a lot of credit, I believe deservedly so, for sort of steering the city in a way that wasn't simply, backroom deals by Brooklyn Pauls or whoever, right? Who actually understood municipal finance and global finance. What reforms were put in place after this near-death or the appearance of a near-death experience?
Very important reforms. Very important reforms. The first was New York City. You're just not going to believe this. New York City did not produce financial statements in accordance with what is GAAP for municipalities. They didn't know at any given time how much cash they had. They didn't know at any given time how many people worked for the city. The accounting systems were terrible. So part of the deal of getting the money from the federal government was putting in place a real accounting system, number one. Number two, when we talked about Kavanaugh putting expenses in the capital budget with long-term bonds, they insisted on having a expense budget and a capital budget that were legitimate. And they put in place the control board, as we mentioned earlier, that was going to approve basically every large contract and expenditure that the city engaged in until the budget got actually balanced. So they gave them about 5 years. They did a little bit sooner to get all the expenses out of the capital budget, to have a real accounting system, real accounting principles, and requiring reports to be issued, which you still get out of New York City every quarter, to get actual truthful numbers. So don't underestimate the importance of that. Secondly, they basically threw the MAC, the Municipal Assistance Corporation, and later the Treasury loan guarantees, took the city out of the bond market, particularly the short-term bond market, in order for the oversupply to work its way through the system. New York City in 1975 had 30% of all the short-term municipal debt in the country. Now, principles of diversification tell you, how could you even do that, right? Because any money manager will say you shouldn't have more than 10% of your investments in any asset class in any one issuer. But it had gotten to that point. So that allowed that to all sort of work its way through the system. And you had a reset over the course of about 3 or 4 years. And perhaps most importantly, you had a resurgence of Wall Street and a New York City mayoral administration with Ed Koch and a city council to some extent that valued the relationship with the private sector. And in the early 80s, the share of the economy that the financial system accounts for in this country started to explode. And all of that tax revenue came to New York because for various reasons, New York had to be the center of the financial services industry in those days.
Yeah, and we should say even, the Wall Street bonuses, Wall Street profits make up a disproportionate part of New York City's budget. Mm-hmm. And so that's true. So we should also say that New York City, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, had a balanced budget requirement, but they basically just ignored it.
Correct.
Sometimes the legislation isn't good, the paper it's written on.
Well, what is a budget, John? It's a projection. It's an estimate. And the estimate is only as good as the assumptions that go into it. They would do things like assume no snowfall, no snow removal costs, right? We're just going to assume they're on. I mean, you would do things like that. So it's only as good as the good faith of the people preparing the budget. Now, that's very important. You talked about the fixes. You came, I don't know whether this is as true as it was in the aftermath of the 75 crisis. You had a true coming together of the financial industry, with Felix Rodin leading the charge on this end, and a man by the name of John Coleman as well, ran the New York Stock Exchange at one point. You had the labor leaders, Victor Gottbaum, Albert Schenker, and others, and you had the state and political leaders all having organizations that formally brought them together to say, look, we've got to go as a united force to Washington to make sure that New York is being represented and we're not being played off against each other like we were in 1975. And that was a very important effort in making certain that New York was appropriately represented in Washington. So whether that coalition can be, you know, resurrected, I think will be an important part of the problems that lay ahead. And I don't, maybe I'm blind to it, but I don't see the private sector, public sector, leadership coming together to really advocate for the city like they did in the aftermath of 75.
That's one of the landmines ahead, right? There's less of a cultural focus on what used to be called the common good.
Correct.
Where everybody put their self-interest aside, held it in check. And that's an idea we desperately need to resuscitate.
Absolutely.
But that's almost a cultural democratic norm. As you look at the state of New York City and other cities and states today, we had a period where, for example, just California, Jerry Brown did a pretty good job of getting its books in order during his governorship.
Things have
splayed a little bit since. I'm underplaying.
And he was governor in 75 too, by the way.
He was.
How long Jerry Brown's been around.
You know, he came back for a second tour of duty and sometimes experience matters. But what dangers do you see on the horizon for New York City, other cities? States can't declare bankruptcy. They're technically sovereign entities. I've written columns about the dangers of, the fiscal instability of some of these, cities and institutions for a long time. But where you stand now, history doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes.
Yeah.
Where do you hear those echoes?
Well, let's walk through those seven factors I talked about first. You had a loss of high-paying jobs, industrial jobs that preceded this. Are we seeing, starting with COVID and continuing, an exodus of the financial industry jobs that we talked about being so critical to the tax base? Hasn't happened yet. What you've seen is no growth. Most of the growth has been in Florida and Texas for those jobs. Haven't really seen a loss yet. But will we see that if you get a mayoral administration that is hostile to higher-income people? Keep a very close eye on that. I'm afraid that might happen.
That's a tax base issue.
Correct. You have an influx of low skilled workers. I think we saw a little bit of that with the migration during the Biden years. So whether that becomes a problem, we'll have to wait and see. But it certainly is. It rhymes with what happens in the lead up to 1975. Now we get to things that don't just rhyme, but actually, maybe repeating themselves. Less aid from Washington. I think in the age of Doge and in the age of Trump, I think we're kidding ourselves if we think we're going to get the level of aid we got in the COVID years with Biden in the White House. So I think that's going to be a gap that's going to have to get filled somehow. Rising interest rates. Now, the rates are nowhere near what they were in the early 70s, but they've certainly risen significantly from zero, which is what they were during the COVID years. And I think, I'm not an interest rate trader. So I know less than or the same as anybody else who's a layman. I think interest rates are probably going to stay elevated relative to what they were and perhaps go higher. And the big wild card is there going to be an economic recession? Okay. Some folks think we're overdue for it with the tariff policy and other stresses put on the economy. That could be ultimately what sparks the flame. Two other things, right? One is New York doing things that other cities don't do? They leave to the state or the private sector. Now, look, if we've got a municipal supermarket business and we're going to have universal babysitting and childcare and other things that cities don't typically do in the next mayoral administration, that may put a significant stress on the budget as well. And the wild card, which we don't know and won't know until the tide goes out, is has there been chicanery and shenanigans in the accounting accounting system and in the budgeting system. That we'll just have to wait and see.
And you know, one thing we should point out is that the budget, for example, of New York City has grown dramatically ahead of the rate of inflation in the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, it's grown tenfold since 75. But yeah, I think it's now what, about 120 billion?
I believe that's right. But yeah. I think it's grown by, 20 or 30 billion over the last, half a dozen years.
Right.
And that's well ahead of the rate of inflation.
Correct.
And yet, I think it's fair to say that people don't always have a clear sense of how that money has been invested. I mean, we did go through a big spate of building on the state and MTA level. I don't want to get too hyper-local for our podcast, but, these are factors. These are all factors that, it's not quite a perfect storm, but you can see some storm clouds on the horizon. And I think part of your takeaway is the peculiar the conditions that helped New York get a bailout in the 1970s. The things that led to that crisis are somewhat in place today. That the reforms that were put in place haven't saved us from ourselves, the political impulses and increased spending and just sort of math that doesn't math, right? I mean, I do blame Republicans for ignoring one entire side of the ledger.
Sure.
I think states and cities need to keep taxes low to remain competitive. But if the federal government says that, you're never going to raise taxes, but you're going to keep increased spending, eventually that math doesn't math.
Absolutely.
What you're saying is the political conditions that helped New York get the bailout in the 1970s don't exist and probably won't exist for any major American city.
I think that's right. I mean, there's not a large majority. Again, even with a small Democratic majority, there are a lot of Democrats in the heartland who are not going to vote for New York City bailout. So I think you need a sizable majority to be guaranteed of approval of a favorable bailout. I mean, ultimately, like I said, no one's going to let New York City devolve into chaos. But what will be the strings attached? Are they going to come in and say, OK, no DEI, no sanctuary city, no this, no that. If you want the money, you've got to run things the way we want to. That may be a bitter pill to swallow.
Well, that's a kind of ideological coercion and cudgel that I think doesn't serve anybody at the end of the day. What I would just like to see is more adherence to basic common sense values from fiscal responsibility, long-term thinking, but also that ethos.
I don't see a lot of that, John. I hate to be a pessimist here. I hope people see the light, but I don't see a lot of common good and responsible thinking out there. And this is bipartisan. In that regard.
I think we've gotten, to the extent Trump is a mirror to our culture, we've sort of internalized this idea that, I'll get mine and everyone else should look out for their number one and it'll all work out, some kind of, Ayn Rand, worldview. And it just reality doesn't work that way. Everyone mm-hmm. needs to keep, human beings are rationally self-interested. That's true. But you got to inculcate an idea, teach an idea that the common good matters, that you need to keep in mind. It can't all be through the prism of self-interest. Otherwise, you descend into a form of chaos that Correct. Doesn't serve everybody, anybody.
Correct.
And not to reduce your incredibly well-reported book to values and lessons we need to apply. But at the end of the day, to the extent that budgets are philosophical documents, they should reflect basic durable values. And maybe that's where we've departed.
Well, again, I think the lesson of the book is without character and without integrity and honesty and straightforwardness, how can you possibly expect a balanced budget or responsible accounting or things to work in a way that work for everyone. Now, the sad coda to the fiscal crisis is that it was the poorest New Yorkers who suffered the most because they don't have lobbyists. They don't have a phone bank where they can come in and promise you to get out your vote. That's who suffers when things go off the rails, which is the real lesson that I think everyone ought to take away.
That should be the lesson. Even if you're making a lot of politically driven promises, it falls apart. It's the poorest folks who get hurt.
And there, but for the grace of God, go us or our children or our grandchildren.
Amen to that. Yep. Character counts.
Yep.
That's absolutely the number one thing. Richard Farley, thank you. Congrats on the publication of a great book, Drop Dead. Recommend it and appreciate your work.
Thank you, John.